This is getting out of hand. Now there are two of them.
Where's your innovation, huh? Sequels suck.
Do the same thing. Everyone's happy.
It's all about money, boys!
Here we go again.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a recording that never happened from a podcast that doesn't exist. I don't know. There are literally no good quotes from this movie. I almost settled on, James, you are under arrest for being that ugly and making that many copies. But it felt a little too mean.
I wouldn't have held it against you. I agree. We're already having to reach for this movie.
All right. And hey, guys, and welcome back to Franchise Fatigue. And this is a podcast where we talk about franchises and how they can be some of the best that a film has to offer, you know, like this gem we're talking about today. What we do is we pick a film series and go through them film by film, you know, exploring them as a singular film and how they fit into the franchise as a whole, and also their influence on culture as a whole. I am your host, Gabe Green, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, James Hamrick. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you, man?
I am doing pretty good. Had to do two takes for that opening, but hey.
We shall get there.
We definitely will. And we are currently in the Men in Black series, and we have the very good fortune today to be talking about the best in the series, Men in Black 2. Yay. And before we get into that, I'd like to ask you guys, if you have a moment, to please go and rate and review us on iTunes and like us on Facebook. And I'm really bad about keeping up with this, and this is probably very, very late, but I would like to thank Ruth Klein for leaving a 5-star review for us on iTunes. We definitely appreciate that. All right, let's jump right into it.
So, obviously, this is a sequel to the original Men in Black. It's separated by about 5 years. Barry Sonnenfeld returned to direct, and between this and the first one, he had directed Wild Wild West, the much beloved and box office smashed Will Smith film. And then the obviously renowned comedy Big Trouble with Tim Allen and Rene Russo. Obviously, both of those were huge box office bombs. And it's kind of crazy that he was able to come back for Men in Black 2 to me. It seems like they would have really wanted to make sure to establish this as a franchise with legs. And he was not entirely on a great streak at that point.
Well, I honestly don't think they were all that smart about franchises even then. I mean, they definitely aren't now. So I don't see why they would have been back in the early 2000s either.
True enough.
So David Koepp was briefly brought on to help write the script, but then he left to go do Spider-Man, which was a very good choice on his part. And so Robert Gordon actually wrote the script, and Brian Fenaro was brought on to do rewrites to pump up the pop culture references, and which supposedly Gordon had specifically avoided, and at Sonnenfeld's behest to condense the first act, which was originally intended to set up the characters and the love story between Jay and Laura, because to quote Sonnenfeld, "I learned on Wild Wild West that audiences don't want to see Will Smith as a straight man," which if that was his lesson from Wild Wild West, that's kind of sad. I generally think Will Smith is at his best playing mostly, I mean, sure, having the snarky quips, but, you know, mostly playing as a straight man. I think that's where he's really good.
Yeah, like you said, of all the problems to learn from Wild Wild West, this isn't the one. I think Will Smith is what made that movie even the slightest bit watchable.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so I doubt this would have ever been good, but knowing that they literally took a razor to the first act and cut out all the character development and added a bunch of the awful, awful pop culture references after the script is kind of infuriating.
Yeah, so after this script was somehow greenlit, obviously casting was underway, and it's not substantiated, but the rumor is that Linda Fiorentino, who played Laurel in the original, was difficult to work with on set, and so none of the cast or crew wanted her back for the sequel. I've even heard before researching for this episode that the earliest versions of this script did have her written in, and she was going to continue to be a major character. And yeah, I've heard the rumor that she was difficult to work with. I've also heard that they just didn't want to continue her as a character and wanted to keep introducing new people. All sorts of weirdness.
Yeah, it's a shame because she was, I think, quite good in the first one. And they obviously set her up to be in a sequel. I've also heard that rumor for quite a while about her. I've heard Tommy Lee Jones specifically did not want to come back if she was here.
Yeah, well, whatever the reasons were, she did not make the final cut. And then Rosario Dawson, who is actually still a pretty newcomer during 2002, was brought on to play Laura. and of course, the name is very creative. change a couple of letters and we've got a new female lead. And originally, Famke Janssen, is that how you pronounce it? I've always been confused on the pronunciation of this
just
name.
Just Famke?
Famke?
That's what I've heard.
She was originally cast as the villainess Serlina, but after only a day of shooting, she had to leave the production for a family emergency, which ended up being a death in the family, actually. And I think this is a time where her face was actually starting to gain more recognition. This is following the original X-Men, and X-Men 2 is just around the corner. So it makes sense why she would have been sought for initially, but
She would have been great.
Yeah, especially even though the third X-Men isn't fantastic, when she goes darker, she could be scary.
Yeah, just play that evil, sexy, super powerful being. She's really good at it. So,
I mean, she was great in Bond.
She's in Bond. So,
I forget which one though, but yeah, she's one of the villains, and she's a female villain in one of those. But was eventually replaced by Lara Flynn Boyle. And I'm sure we're all over the moon about that.
Oh, yeah.
For the character of Scrad and Charlie, I forget which one's just the stupid head tentacle thing. But the part was actually auditioned for by Robert Downey Jr. and Keanu Reeves.
Together?
Not together.
That would be amazing.
But that would have been amazing. The thought of, I don't know which one I would want to be the near disembodied head more. I feel like seeing Robert Downey Jr. as the snarky head just kind of annoying this more stoic and reserved Keanu Reeves would have been incredible. But, of course, that didn't happen, and the part went to Johnny Knoxville. And again, I'm sure Gabe is just thrilled. And then this character is not of huge note, but David Cross of Arrested Development fame returns for the sequel. But what's weird is I don't think anybody really knows if he's the same guy from the first one or not. Because, of course, he was the receptionist at the morgue who seemingly died. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he looked pretty dead.
Yeah, and I was looking up things, and I think on one of the wiki sites for Men in Black, it lists him as the same person, but on another site, it said they are completely different characters. And
he has the same name, though. I don't understand.
I think he's referred to as Tony in the first one, and it's like Newton in the second one.
Okay, well, Wikipedia has him in both films as Newton.
See, that's part of the thing. People have listed him in the first one as Newton, but I think he's actually credited as Tony. I've always been confused by this. But for whatever reason, David Cross is back. And then,
just as awkward as ever. At least in the Men in Black films.
But with none of the great writing that we're familiar with from his other work. And then Barry Sonnenfeld himself actually has a cameo in the room that they come in, that full of all of the guns that Kay has stashed away. He actually plays the father there.
And so like the first one, filming was done in New York City, and also like the first one, the climax had to be entirely reworked at the last minute. However, this time it was because they had shot it with the World Trade Center as the backdrop, which, this being 2002, that wouldn't have worked. And so the rooftop climax had to be entirely reshot with a less sensitive background. Rick Baker returned for the still pretty great creature, at least practical creature effects and makeup. And Industrial Light and Magic did the not-so-great CGI. And our favorite composer, Danny Elfman, once again did the score.
He's still reminding me why I still have a somewhat soft spot, but I will forever be jaded.
All right, so James, I think we already have a bit of an inkling of our thoughts on this film. So you care to expand on your overall opinion?
So I will admit that watching it again, I hate it slightly less. It's moved from just being something I loathe entirely from my most inner being to, in my eyes, just the film embodiment of meh. It's just here. It's got a lot of bad. It's got a couple of redeeming qualities. But to me, it's just almost a roadblock, something I have to get around to get from 1 to 3. So it's really not the worst thing in the entire world, but it's not great.
Yeah, this is going to sound weird, but when I first saw these, I think I liked 2 a bit better, mainly because it actually had a plot that moved.
I'm going to argue on that one.
I was a young, foolish child, and I definitely didn't like it much on the second viewing. But yeah, I do agree with you. I honestly can't summon enough care to actually hate this movie. And I think it does the best thing a bad movie can do and be very short and very brisk. It's only 88 minutes long. That's including lengthy opening and closing credits, which, that's crazy for a big blockbuster like this. But it works because the plot is always moving and we're in and out pretty fast. So it's hard to actually, you know, hate the movie in spite of how bad it often is. You know, to go into the characters, despite Sonnenfeld's fears about Will Smith playing a straight man, I actually kind of love him in the first 10 or so minutes where he's being the confident, somewhat grumpy senior agent. I love that his neuralizer speeches are much less peppy and are kind of prone to turn into rants against idiotic people. And I just think he just works really great as that. I think I like him better when his humor is more subdued and less, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air kind of super big, and that he kind of reverts back to that old character again, as Kay comes back. But I like that there was actually legitimate character growth in the beginning, in the opening. You see where he is now as opposed to where he was in the first one. Even though it's all undone, I do very much enjoy seeing that.
Yeah, it's weird that this is what Sonnenfeld considered could have been the potential problem with the script, because like you, I actually really liked Smith at the beginning. The idea that the young gun, cocky guy who's always making jokes at the expense of the seriousness of the situation is now 5 years later, like the veteran, and even more picky and more demanding than Kay was in the original.
Neuralize another one, huh?
Yeah, like the guy who's always, just berating Kay for flashy thinking people is now the guy who's neuralizing everybody. Even back to back, when he allows himself to go on that long rant and then he just does it like halfway through his rant, this is a training exercise. And there are a couple of, it's not nearly as fun to look for as it was in the first, where like just these little gags and jokes and lines in the background, but there's a couple here. I love after that, like the camera pulls way back and as he walks you can still see him kind of walk by the conductor and neuralize him as he just walks past. So there's still some of the humor, and I think Will Smith is still great in the role, But yeah, all of this growth, this idea that the character's trying to, are almost stuck, like unable to move on past K, and has just become, you know, obsessive over this job. It's an interesting place to go after the first, and then whenever K gets back, it's Will Smith from the first movie again. And I love the first movie, but you don't just keep doing what worked before. I still love several of his moments when K comes back and on. Even though, I mean, some of the moments kind of stay around too long, they're still pretty funny. And I love after they're flushed and he's just kind of trying to justify, like, man, old you used to love this. You'd say flush me again. Like, he's still having fun with it. But they do kind of drop his character and then try to pretend that they've been working on it the whole time whenever the climax comes. It's like, no, you stopped caring 20 minutes in. You don't get to pretend to have done anything significant by the end.
Yeah, and I like that he does. He like starts on the whole speech, you know, we're going to go put on the last suit you'll ever wear again. Yeah, because, you know, never mind. it's just not the same. And I think I like when it's kind of self-aware like that. And I think Tommy Lee Jones is actually giving a pretty good performance. You know, as this man who feels kind of lost and doesn't know why. Like, you really sense that there's something missing from his life. And he feels it too, but he's, you know, he's the surly, you know, jerk as well, so he's not gonna admit it, but just you really get that kind of underlying sadness from his performance. And the fact that he can sell lines like, you know, you're not sad because it rains because you're sad, baby, is a real testament to how good of an actor he is, because that's not good. It's really bad. But, you know, no matter like how terrible the stuff he has given this film, he's always really trying. I think he does get some decent heartfelt moments.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like him as your friendly postal service worker is kind of hilarious.
There is a mental health clinic down the street.
Like, just seeing him pick up the box and say, like, this is how to not do it. Like, everybody just seems to, like, I imagine in my head, you know, everybody knows him, everybody goes, and he knows everybody there. I think that's all really fun and funny, but what I hate is that it comes at the cost of his marriage, and that's something that I really, really hold against this movie. Is this was made because of the love that people had for the first one. Like, obviously that's why most sequels are made, but this movie seems all too willing to kind of throw away things from the first one, like with Laurel just being tossed aside. And maybe I'm an idiot, but whenever he says he just helped her get back to the morgue, was that an implied death, or did he just neuralize her and put her back as a worker?
He neuralized her, because they're just talking about how his propensity for neuralizing partners.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, so I guess it seemed like she couldn't keep up with the life. And I actually don't really mind the fact... I know we talked about this in the first one, but I didn't really care that much about the characters. So the fact that he didn't get his, you know, he didn't get his happily ever after, yeah, it's kind of sad. I honestly don't really hold against the film. What I kind of do hold against it is the fact that it's literally trying to capture beat for beat, you know, the dynamic from the first one by reverting the characters all back to them old selves. And then, you know, bringing in a female character and then treating her and, you know, basically doing with her exactly what they did with Laurel from the first one. It just feels like they're really trying to recapture the same beats. And the ending is, the climax is almost identical. I don't care. I don't really, it doesn't bother me at all that he lost his wife. And I think the most poignant moments in the film are from Tommy Lee Jones and the fact that he did, you know, go back to his life. But there's, the fact he still has a gaping, you know, 40-year hole in him as a person, which Yeah, that would affect you. And the fact that he couldn't make a marriage survive, I think, is sad, but I think it works dramatically. So yeah, I don't mind that at all, but I don't like that it was done simply to get everything back to the same status quo that everybody loved about Men in Black.
Well, I hated it. And to me,
but don't you think that wouldn't, you know, missing 40 years of your life make you, and well, also knowing that something is not right, wouldn't that make you a different person? And
it would, but you have to earn that. This movie throws that away pretty quickly.
I don't. And I think it lasts for a good, you know, 20, 30 minutes, or I don't even know. This one's so short, but it lasts for a good while. After they bring him back, they try to neuralize him, and he's just like, I help you. You show me why I look at the stars. You know, it goes on for a while, and they keep trying, and he just can't get himself
back.
That
was the ending of that, like that first scene. That line is never really readdressed. He never shows him why he would look at the stars. It was my exact same problem I had with Will Smith's character, which is Will Smith at the beginning is like this person who's unable to find someone and to like have some sort of constant in his life other than like the fact that he's in charge and he's doing these things and, you know, going through partner after partner, unsatisfied. And then Kay comes back and like all of his growth stops, and they try to continue his growth by like introducing Laura and having like, oh, maybe this is the person he's been looking for, this and that, but that's not really it. I have the same problem with Cade, where it's like, as he's first introduced back, you know, he has that line, you know, tell me why I used to look at the stars, or I help you and you'll tell me why I used to look at the stars. We never go back to that. We have a couple of fun little moments with trying to get his memories back, and as soon as he does, it's right back to Tommy Lee Jones from the first one. I just feel like any idea of him being that lonely person, other than this weird setup with like the other alien that he apparently had feelings for.
Yeah, that flashback is awful. It makes no sense. But yeah, I think that is trying to, the idea that he also, you know, neuralized himself in the past to forget about something that was, you know, super painful to him. I think they're trying to build off that idea, but it really doesn't connect very well.
And for me, I really did, even though, you know, I would not say that there's any real depth to the characters from the first, I just think they're so likable. And what heart the first one did have, because I think the first one has a whole lot of heart. And I think the most it had was in the form of, ironically enough, Tommy Lee Jones and his just angry old man. But this, I just hate that the entire ending of the first one is undermined. You know, he had now realized, you know, how much of his life he had given to the Men in Black. And now he was finally taking a chance to look at the stars. Because he didn't look at the stars because of Men in Black. He left Men in Black because of the reasons he would. Because he finds them beautiful and they became mundane and that. And he's going to go back and enjoy life. So now them saying, here, let me help you. Or like, you'll help me and I'll show you why you used to look at the stars. It's the opposite. No. You were already living the life that you led because of your desire to stop and take in them. It felt weird and completely like not in line at all with what the first one was saying.
But I really like the idea that this life has consequences. You know, that is set against you know, Will Smith, kind of his like slowly degrading mental state, and the fact that you know, there's that scene between him and Patrick Warburton in the in the diner where they're eating pie, of course, and he's telling him, you know, you can't take this job if you want to be a hero. Have you ever heard of James Edwards, which is his name, his original name? He's like, no, no, and, you know, he just saved 78 people today, and no one will ever know. I think the original script is definitely trying to get at the idea that this life has serious personal consequences, and I think both of the characters reflect that quite well. At least in the first act.
Yeah, but Tommy Lee Jones never got to the age of his partner in the first one. He left early because even though he was definitely, you know, older, especially than Will Smith's character, he still wasn't at the point of retirement. He left because of the consequences and because he still couldn't let go of this life. And so he gave it up and he got his life back before his entirety of his life was was taken up by this organization. And if you're going to sell the idea of this life has consequences, don't do it at the expense of like the emotional climax of your previous film. Don't, if you're paving the way for the new generation and retiring the old one early, so that, because it's weird that the dynamic shift of the first one, I kind of like, where you think Will Smith may not be cut out for this and Tommy Lee Jones is so almost bored by it that he treats it mundane. When, like, the further we got on, the more we realized that Will Smith is now the character, or Jay is now the character who's ready to lead this life, and it's Kay who has been unable to really fully embrace it because he's still, you know, he still has this desire to, you know, look up and look at this woman from afar. He's, you know, it seems like he's the one who's been unable to do it. So I like the fact that he bowed out from the organization early. And then the second one just starts, nope, you waited too late here. It's just, it annoys me that it's just this huge disregard of the niceties of the first one. I don't know.
I actually cared about the first one, I would be mad.
That's on you.
I do appreciate this film's singular attempt at having some sort of deeper meaning, even if it's thrown out in the third act, whatever. But I do appreciate it's that
thrown they thrown out way before the third act.
Yeah, I do appreciate that they at least sort of halfway kind of maybe tried.
But you could do that with Jay. There's no reason I think that you have to do it with both characters.
I don't know. for the villain, Serlina, why couldn't this have been Famke Janssen? I mean, it would have still been a bad character, even with her. Because, like, I don't know what the MacGuffin is she wants. I don't know why she wants the MacGuffin. I don't know why she hates these other people. I don't know why she actually won't actually kill anyone, other than that anti-rape PSA in the beginning. It's just, I don't know what she's, why, what she wants. I don't know what, anything about her. And on top of that, the actress is terrible. I'm sure she's a nice lady, but she can't act. And it's really, really painful to watch her on screen. Every time she's trying to be threatening or monologuing about stuff we have no context for understanding, it's just, I don't care. And why is she in lingerie for half her screen time? There's absolutely no reason. It's just, yeah, I mean, I'm sure she has potential as an underwear model, but she's not an actress.
Yeah, this felt like a weird attempt at recreating, like, obviously not the same kind of character as Edgar, but just another fun, quirky villain in the skin of someone else. Although here it's not fun because it's not someone else's actual skin, and she is no Vincent D'Onofrio. Yeah, I think with the first one, there's something weird about the first one where, to me, the lack of knowledge with the villain kind of works. He's just this alien bug thing that's bitter and wants to kill everybody pretty much. You know, when he says, "Ever peel the wings off a fly? Wonder what happens if a fly fights back?" Like, it was very shallow, but it was fun, and the shallowness was able to hide behind just a great, fun character. Here, the complete lack of motivations is on full display because you don't have a meaningful and fun character to hide behind. And so we don't know why she wants the light. We don't know what the light is. I don't know. The first thing she found is this picture of this lingerie model. Sure, whatever, you're going to do that at first to try to, like, use that to your advantage to get somewhere else, but
they don't even use it. She never. They don't use the fact that she's like. There's no, like, seduction scene or anything. It just doesn't even play into the film.
And what's weird is the movie thinks it does, because I forget the actual line, but she says something about, like, being able to, like, you are one. Someone could rule this world with the right. Yeah. With the right mammary glands. Something super weird. But it made no sense because she just showed up there and started, like, killing people, or I forget what she did.
Tentacling them or whatever.
whip him with these tentacles, but there was no seduction. And then she made comments like there was, and it was, I don't know. This whole character is so weird. And I thought the introduction of the character was pretty fun with the alien spaceship.
They're playing with the scale and whatnot. That was fun.
But after that, it's just such a boring character.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the Light of Zartha?
Yeah.
You have Lara, played by Rosario Dawson, who I really, really love her. She is a really fantastic actress, and she's in a lot of bad movies, but I think she always elevates them. And I think she does this one as well. But this is a super thankless role. You can tell that there were literally pages and pages of script just cut out at the beginning, because literally the first scene, after she just witnessed her boss get murdered, and Will Smith questions her, is like, okay, and then he leaves, and Frank asks, did you tell your lover? You're like, what? He just literally met her all of 5 minutes ago, and now the film expects us to buy this kind of deep emotional connection between the two of them. And from then on, it acts like they really care about each other. Like, we've had a whole half hour of character development that is not there. Which is sad, because I think they have really decent chemistry together with Will Smith. But it just makes no sense within the time span or even the context of what we're given. They never actually have even a real conversation about, who they are as people. And then she just kind of used exactly like she gets, she gets kidnapped at the beginning of the third act, exactly like the first one. They have to go rescue her. And then all of a sudden, oh, wait, you're the Light of Zartha. What is the Light of Zartha? How are you it? What does that mean? Why does this plant lady want you? Why do you have to leave? Why will you destroy the planet in 10 minutes? None of that is explained. It's supposed to be this. And also there's this subplot where Tommy Lee Jones had a relationship with her mother. Is he supposed to be her father? I don't know. I don't know what's going on. None of it makes sense. The flashback that's supposed to explain everything only makes it even more confusing. Why did Earth not want to harbor them? And why, if they were afraid of getting involved, why did they get involved? I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's really bad. Like you, I think Dawson is a really great actress. But there's nothing for her to do in this movie. One of the things that kind of bothered me was I feel like her being able to embrace this kind of reality was almost meant to be taken seriously. Like, whenever Will Smith explains the situation to her and she just says, okay, all right. I think that's supposed to be a real moment. And Will Smith's like, oh, wow, none of this is really phasing her and she's okay with it. And that kind of furthers his, connection with her, I guess.
Being only the second time he's ever met her.
Yeah. And so to me, what's weird is that, as we talked about in the first one, people kind of underreact to finding out about aliens living among us. With Will Smith finding out, he's he's freaked out at first, but he's fully on board just a little bit later. And then even the Laurel from the morgue, they all buy into it pretty quickly. So it's weird that he's so impressed so impressed with Laura kind of believing it so quickly and almost having that be part of the reason why he doesn't want to neuralize her, and it causes him to grow to care for her even more. It's just weird because this is how characters in the first one typically reacted to finding out about this. Their lack of screen time is a big problem, because even Kay says the whole "why didn't you tell her you loved her" thing that Frank did. It's like this thing that the movie keeps saying to Will Smith, saying to the audience, hey, this is what Will Smith should be doing. And I, as a member of the audience, am like, no, it's not. He doesn't know her. And with a lot of action movies, you're almost able to forgive the quick, kind of rushed love story because they experience something crazy with each other at first, and they go through experience some sort of trauma. he was an agent that debriefed her. There was no shared experience. There was nothing. And so I have no reason to care about their relationship at all. I have no, even though I love the actress, I have no reason to care about her. And so when you get to this emotional climax, I couldn't be more ambivalent. And I think the first one knew that it hadn't really built up this big emotional arc between any characters. So the last action scene was just fun. It was just a big, dumb, fun scene with the giant cockroach. Here, you've got, we're cutting between Tommy Lee Jones giving lines like, you know, you're not sad because it rains because you're sad, and having these supposed serious moments juxtaposed with Will Smith being flayed around in the air screaming like he did in the first one. And so, like, wait, am I supposed to be laughing? Is this supposed to be serious? I don't care about her. I don't believe he's really that in love with her. I certainly don't believe Tommy Lee Jones was ever in love with your mother.
And to make it all worse, we don't understand any of the plot points happening right now.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because she's a great actress, and obviously I love Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, but even they could not save these arcs and this plot, which there really is none.
Yeah, and coming to some of the side characters that unfortunately get way too much screen time. There is Frank the Pug, who is absolutely awful.
Wrong.
And serves zero purpose in this movie and is completely phased out of the third act without accomplishing a single freaking thing. Every line he has is terrible. He is annoying as heck. And he could go die for all I care.
I'm disappointed.
You like him?
He is the I kind of love Frank. I love him and whatever those shrimp aliens are.
Oh gosh. I was so happy when they came into the room and they were all in pieces. Like, oh yes, they finally killed them. And then they put themselves back together.
Well, you can go and be bitter somewhere else. I have to have one thing to enjoy about this movie, and it's incredibly juvenile. It really is. I mean, I laughed way too much, but what it just randomly cuts back to him. He's like, wrecked him. I nearly killed him. It's the stupidest jokes imaginable. But for whatever reason, the eighth grader in me was just laughing through most of it. And Frank the Pug just cracked me up. I don't know why. There's something about seeing that voice or hearing that voice come from that dog. It makes me laugh.
It worked for 30 seconds in the first film. As soon as he's introduced here, the novelty's gone, and every word he says is garbage.
He's
and
still good.
Then there is Scrat and Charlie, played by Johnny Knoxville, and he's even worse, and he's even less important to the film. He means, like, why is he in this movie? What does he accomplish ever? And yet he's given all this screen time, and the film is constantly stopping for him to give awful, awful jokes and, like, little sketches that don't work. That's kind of a symptom of how just kind of bankrupt all the humor in this movie is. But like these two characters in particular, for me, just not only do they serve no function whatsoever, every second of screen time is just kind of infuriating.
Yeah, to me, it's weird because the first one, we really don't have any character that stays very long other than the two leads, Laurel a little bit, and then obviously the villain. And we've got all these other fun side characters that we visit here and then we visit there. And like if it's an alien, the design is always, you know, really creative and fun. If it's an actor, they kind of have fun with it, like David Cross as the morgue receptionist. They come and they go real quick because the movie knows they're not real characters. The same should have been done with Johnny Knoxville here, just because if we want to show off this weird two-headed alien guy, whatever.
One Johnny Knoxville is too much. I don't need two of them.
Yeah. First of all, it would have been better. I mean, Robert Downey Jr., who said no to that? I need to know.
Probably Robert Downey Jr.
Maybe. but he should have been like the other characters from the first, where we maybe get a fun little scene, like Jeeves.
Yeah, pretty well used here. I mean, enough.
Yeah, he's, but I'm like, he should have been used the way Jeeves was in the first one. If you had to be used, just come and go. Don't try to force his relevance, because there is none. There's no he has no bearing on the plot. We have no history with the character. There's not even really there's barely even an implied history. He serves no real purpose here. I think they just thought. I think his inclusion was almost entirely based on his design, and they're like, you know, what would be like a funny kind of alien? This, and you know, it'd be great is if we kept him in the movie. But he's not a character, and he's just kind of annoying.
Yeah. All right. Any other characters you want to mention?
Zed is in this for a little bit. He has like one line that I laughed at where they asked if Serlina's an old girlfriend, and he just like matter-of-factly says she wishes, and he just kind of keeps talking. But
I like his moment with Michael Jackson. Oh, you're breaking up. I can't hear you. Bye.
Yeah, and I love that they got him to come in. That was a funny moment.
Because he was definitely an alien.
But I hate his weird action moment.
Oh, gosh.
Where he does these flips in the office and that bicycle kick in mid-air. Like, that was... I cannot describe how flat that fell for me. That was so beyond stupid. And it's like you've got this character actor who's really, really fun in the role, and you give him like two moments of dialogue and the stupidest action beat of the series, and that's how you use him? Like, because I mean, he wasn't overused in the first, but he was a presence there throughout, and he was just barely relevant here, if at all. And I was really disappointed with this film's usage of him.
Yeah. All right. And I kind of want to talk about Barry Sonnenfeld's direction, and I kind of don't because it's terrible. I have a very difficult time believing that he was actually a cinematographer prior to this, because he was actually the Coen brothers' go-to for like their first three or four films. But this film is so ugly looking. It literally only consists of like three shot choices. Like, it seems like 80% of the film is just like medium wide, and then a medium close up, while people just kind of stand together facing the camera talking. And just the entire film is directed like that. There's no visual variety anywhere, and the direction of the action is particularly dreadful. I mean, I think it was pretty lame in the first one, but here it's just so bad. It's all really shoddy green screen, and there's no momentum. There's no threat. It's just like when Will Smith is fighting Jaro, it's so slow, and he just like stops and has a whole speech, and then one of them will come, he'll fight him a bit, and then he'll fall and he'll be thrown around, and then he'll talk for a while. That it's just like there's no momentum, there's no stakes, there's nothing, there's no weight to any of the action. The effects are not good. There was a lot of great practical effects in the first one. There's a way more bad CGI here. It's just I don't think there's a single moment of good direction in this entire film. Which, I mean, I don't think the first one was particularly, the direction was great, but it was at least pretty competent. Here it is, it looks so haphazard and lazy. Like, everything feels like it was shot on a, like, it's like, almost like the bad, you know, the bad parts you remember from the prequels, where it's just people standing around talking in front of green screens. That's what a lot of this film feels like, except for the backgrounds don't even look good.
Yeah, with the first one, you know, even though there wasn't, the direction of the first one wasn't to be hugely admired, but like you said, it was competent enough, and what flaws there were to me were almost able to be hid behind just the amount of style that the movie had. I think it had its own quirks and it used that to its advantage, but here it's just bland. It's just poorly shot and boring. And one of the things that you said that I really agree with was there is no weight and there's no sense of danger to anything. Because while the first Men in Black wasn't like Indiana Jones level of like beat your character up and put him through all sorts of hell and then have him, you know, just barely able to fight back. At least in the first one, you know, when Will Smith got thrown back by the cricket, it looked like he flew into something and he got hurt. Whatever, he got punched by anything, it wasn't entirely believable, but at least it looked like there was impact and meaning.
And a lot of people died. There's a high body count, a surprisingly high body count in that movie.
Yeah, and here, I mean, we open up with the Jeff scene, and he's going like at a subway speed, and he's like hitting his head on all these metallic signs, and they're like not falling or like knocking him on his back, and he's getting right back up. And Jeff whips him with the tail and throws him like 50 feet into the air, and he's just kind of back up, and he's like, you know, cracking wise immediately after.
Yeah, his head would have fallen off like Dennis Hopper's.
Yeah, it's so unbelievable. And it, I mean, I know that, again, the first one wasn't realistic, really, in any sense of the word, but it felt like it had a certain level of believability in the way that the characters got knocked around. But here, it just went so over the top that nothing meant anything here. Will Smith can talk about, you know, how bad he, or Rosario Dawson can, like, talk about how concerned she was for him. I'm like, what? No, it was just,
and
this is nothing.
It's not even, like, fun over the top, like when, you know, Peter Jackson or Gore Verbinski does it, where it's at least kind of creative. Here, it's just all just bad.
Yeah, it comes at the expense of believability, and the reward is like, look, he got hit real hard. Isn't that funny? Not, look, I set up and staged this over-the-top sequence that, while ridiculous, is a lot of fun. It's literally just, they're getting hit in the head. This guy is punching this guy. It's just, there's nothing creative about it. And so you're asking me to suspend what little disbelief there already was, and I mean, you're asking me to suspend my disbelief when you've already asked me so far, and you're not making it worth it. It was just none of this action was fun or believable or did any of the things that action in movies is supposed to do.
Very well put. Yeah, I guess I might as well mention a couple of things I liked. I actually quite liked the opening credits. I think the CGI was pretty decent, and I think it was visually interesting. You know, I don't understand why planets are blowing up from the Sixth Sensei ship, but at least it looked kind of cool. And I also really enjoyed the conspiracy theory TV show opening. I think that was a very clever idea. You know, the whispers and rumors of the Men in Black, and obviously it's like super cheesy and low budget, but I don't know. It was a fun, clever way to open the film, even if nothing afterwards substantiated that.
Yeah, there was, for a brief moment, there was a while where I was thinking, was I wrong about this? Is this just a really fun movie? Like a fun, dumb movie? Because I liked the opening credits too. I thought the way they played with scale at the beginning with the ship was really fun. I think Patrick Warburton can say any singular line and it'd be funny.
That I liked him here. I think they really wasted him. I think if with a good script, him and Will Smith and that kind of character dynamic could have been brilliant. As is, I think it's kind of fine and kind of fun because it's Patrick Warburton being goofy. But it's like just another one of those missed opportunities.
Yeah, this movie is full of those. But I mean, but like I said, I liked what we got of him, even though we didn't get nearly enough. And then seeing, you know, Will Smith going back and being like the almost bitter, jaded vet now, I was like, wait, I'm liking a lot of this. I was wrong, and I'll admit that I was wrong. And then it moved on, and I was like, oh, never mind. It's bad. But I did like the conspiracy show as well. I kind of wish that they didn't actually bring it back in and like view it within the context of the movie. To me, that was just a really fun, that would have been a really fun way to just exist as an opening and like just to acknowledge that. It felt weird to see it come back because then I was just thinking, well, why do we see it twice? but that's a very minor complaint.
And with actual writing, it could have been an extremely clever device to get through some like important exposition, and they try to use it at that, except for it doesn't actually explain anything. All right. So I guess it's I don't even, it sounds like I do, but I honestly don't even hate this film. It's just as you said, it kind of just exists. It's definitely a bad movie, but I think it moves well enough, and the cast is obviously kind of having fun, so it's like I could kind of forgive its existence, but just try to forget about it.
Yeah, for me, I feel like a lot of my complaints here were your complaints with the first one, with the plot, where, like you said, this one follows the beat so closely that all of your issues with the first one made more sense here, and I could see them in the first one now. But what it pointed out was at least the first one had enough fun and was competent enough that it was able to hide that, because we still have the character being introduced to all this while cutting back to the villain doing vague things in a plot that barely exists, and this female character that just comes in towards the end but doesn't really have any meaning in the class. It's very, very similar to me. The pacing is similar. Even the structure of order of events, it's all super similar. It's just, this one's just not fun to watch in the moment.
It's the flaws of the first film on steroids. Right, so I think we've beat on this film enough. So on its initial release, it got mixed reviews. Like, it kind of feels like kind of a Phantom Menace thing where people are just like, oh, that was fine. Because I think it got like a 38% on Rotten Tomatoes, but reading through a lot of reviews, it felt like, oh, it's fun CGI, the characters are great, yeah, it's okay. It's a decent sequel. But definitely, as time has gone on, I don't know of a single human being who likes this movie. And I think it's definitely, honestly, people don't even talk about Men in Black anymore outside of the first one, which next week, I don't think that's fair, because next week we'll be discussing 3, which I really like. But really, it seems that people just simply like to ignore that this film even exists.
Yeah, I was about to say, it certainly isn't remembered as the prequels, because the prequels are remembered.
I was talking about the prequels' initial reception, the kind of more moderate to positive reception.
Yeah, whereas as the prequels were hated more and more, this was just forgotten almost entirely.
Yeah, it's just kind of a pretty perfect example of, you know, the really bad kind of early 2000s blockbuster filmmaking, where they just thought they could do anything with CGI, and it's still, CGI still had that wow factor, which didn't last at all. Really, it's like any film that tries to just wow with CGI, unless it's made by James Cameron or George Lucas, just basically looks dated by the next year. So don't do that. Just tell a good story. How about that? All right. So next week, we will be closing out our series on the Men in Black with Men in Black 3, which is actually my favorite of the series. So I am really looking forward to that.
I was pleasantly surprised with how much I really, really like this next one. So I shall be in a better mood, I assure you.
Absolutely. All right. So if you like that and you want to follow us, you can like us on Facebook. We are there as Franchise Fatigue Podcast. And you can follow us on Twitter. We are there at Franchised Pod. And if you want to find our older episodes, you can go to FranchiseFatiguePodcast.com. And James, where can people follow you?
You can follow me on Letterboxd. I am there at JL Hamry. That's JLHAMRI. I am also on Facebook, just as James Hamrick. And where you could probably see me interacting most is various film Facebook groups like Popcorn Theology and Feel and Film Discussion. There's a lot of great movie discussions going on there.
And I am also on Letterboxd as Gabriel Green. I rate and sometimes review all the films I see. And I am occasionally on Twitter at Gabe E. Green. I'll tweet once or twice a month or something. So if you want to follow me there, you can.
So until next week, we will see you in the sequel.
See ya.